The Money Show.
Business books.
Tonight's business book is one whose author's name I cannot pronounce because I think he is Russian. The business book is called This Is Not Propaganda. It's by an author by the name of Peter. Bronwyn Williams, future finance specialist at Flux Trends. What is Peter's surname, Bronwyn?
Pomerantsev. There you go. It's not so bad.
Okay, I can do Pomerantsev. Is Peter Pomerantsev Russian by any chance? I mean, is he Russian of a certain age? Can he remember a time in Russia of misinformation and lies and deceit? Or, I mean, does he still live there and is he aware of massive lies and deceit and information?
Well, he's certainly well qualified to speak about this and misinformation. He was born in the Soviet Union, and his family moved to the United Kingdom. And what's interesting about this book, I think before we carry on, we just have to give a moment credit to its most beautiful cover. It's obviously doing this over the radio, but it's a thing of beauty. It looks like one of those little old golden books that, you know, they used to have fairy tale stories in them. It's got a picture of a unicorn and a rainbow. And it just really does speak to the whole complete fantasy land that we're able to spend when we go down the propaganda and the misinformation road.
It is a magnificent book cover, and it does look like a fairy tale cover of your dreams. And the book is called This Is Not Propaganda. And it is, I mean, if Donald Trump leaves a lasting legacy, it will be the ability to twist facts to suit himself. We, of course, in South Africa, we had the Guptas doing it with those nasty sods at Bell Pottinger's expert assistance, because we get played all the time. And Peter Pomerantsev, his mission is to immunize us against that abuse.
Yes. So what's particularly interesting about this book, and why I think it's relevant to read now, particularly in the debate of deplatforming and censorship and whether it should be regulated or whether social media platforms should have their own council like Facebook is doing now and all the rest of it, is what Peter Pomerantsev has really tried to do here is to just give you the stories and make us make our own minds up, which I think is very clever because that's essentially what we have to do, because in the world we live in right now, there's no one that we can just trust outright. Even fact-checkers have been caught with their pants down to sort of speak a little bit figuratively, and who fact-checks the fact-checkers? And it really does come down to us all being more aware of what's going on around us. And he's done that very effectively by entwining stories about real propaganda and fake news and misinformation campaigns from all across the world. But he's also put that together with his own family story of their escape from the Soviet Union and from a very surreal place, which is why the cover image is so useful for understanding this whole story. As the sort of subtext goes, he calls it Adventures in the War Against Reality, which I think we're all starting to understand now over the last few months and years.
I think we most certainly are. And again, because the way in which information dissemination has changed, the way in which the world has evolved, it's become increasingly difficult to separate fact from fiction. And so often when we are confronted with the, and you said this in a tweet a little earlier, wildly convicting versions of reality, we will select the one that suits us. We have biases. We are wired to go to the stories we believe to be true.
Yes, we want this for various different reasons. So obviously we want the sort of social credit that comes from being a supporter of a particular in-group because it's very validating to our own narcissism and to our own, all those chemicals in our brain that make us feel like we're part of a group. And this pushes us to believe more and more extreme things because our side did. You know, this is how sort of conspiracy tends to grow. But I think his point goes slightly deeper than that. And that is, we get into a dangerous point where we don't even have an incentive to look for the truth, because the truth might be more uncomfortable than the fantasy reality that we find ourselves in. And in some of the work that I've been doing, talking about post-Gelder, which I think you've spoken about on your show too, where the future is a scary place and the past is sort of being distorted. I mean, even now we've got the Washington Post saying that they're going to sort of, you know, edit past stories to sort of keep up with the times, sort of unstuck between, like, you know, a fictionalized history and a completely unknown present. Who wants to deal with facts? Why can't we just stay in our little fantasy bubble? And this is the danger he's really speaking about in this book. But giving up on even the will to know what's right.
and it is hard. I mean, and information dissemination at the best of times is very, very difficult. So how does he suggest we get over ourselves? Because, I mean, when truth collapses, nothing else is sacrosanct. I mean, it's actually, I think we've learned to our cost in recent years just how important truth is.
Yes, I think the first thing that's worth pointing out that he does point out both sort of explicitly and implicitly is that by outsourcing our belief to any sort of authority, be that a government, be that a censorship bureau, be that a social media platform, be that a fact checker, be that a media house or a journalist, we lose a lot of our agency over what we're taking in, and that we would be better advised to use our own brains. And one of the case studies I really like there, because it does, of course, you know, flatter my own biases, is that he cited a researcher called Angela Wu, based on something in the U.S. right now, but she did a very big study on people in China, and she looked for people specifically who were able to resist propaganda messages that were accepted by the general public and pushed by public authorities too. So in other words, people that were able to resist mis- and disinformation even when everyone else believed them. And the one thing she found in common with people that were able to think for themselves was that they had read widely from a very young age. That was quite an interesting point for me, because I do think it does give you a bit of a bigger perspective. And when you are reading wider, you are at least taking in different sources and different worldviews. And she wasn't specific about saying read more newspaper articles. She was saying people that read just generally widely, people that are being exposed to things like fact and fiction, fiction and nonfiction, all different types of writing, had given them a more robust worldview that was less susceptible to being distorted by any particular point of failure.
And again, without turning into a bitter and nasty cynic, we can, I think, read with a degree of skepticism that is healthy.
Yes, but I think if you do read widely, you do tend to develop that bit of healthy skepticism, because you are being exposed to different worldviews. And no two texts are going to have the same opinion. That is the blessing of sitting down and reading, is that you are forced to sort of shut up and listen. You're not able to interrupt them like you are if you're on a social media feed, or if you've got many tabs open in the browser. If you're literally reading a book, whatever book it is, you have to sort of listen to the author. You're unable to argue with them until they've got their whole point across. People that have developed that discipline are able to sort of evaluate sources a bit more. It does come with a caveat, because I read another study this week that says that people that have lots of higher education, which could be seen as a proxy for people that read a lot of books, tend to have more extreme and more irrational political biases themselves. So we should be careful not to conflate education with a broader perspective on the world too.
No, absolutely. I mean, some of the smartest people I know are completely ignorant of the world. And that is frightening to me, how ignorant people can be outside of their sort of area of expertise, for example, and just how terrifying it can be dealing with people who are oblivious to the fact that they're being played the whole time. And I think we see the dangers of it playing out when we look at the attack on the U.S. Capitol. I mean, it is the clearest and most present recent example of just how dangerous information mismanagement is.
Yeah, exactly. And that speaks very nicely, that whole sort of parallel between smart people not being unsusceptible to misinformation, is the whole sort of deferring to authority fallacy, where we tend to think that people that are experts in one area are automatically experts in another area. It's almost like the loudest voice in the room gets more pseudo credibility from us. And that's also why, you know, Peter Pomerantz said in this book, is he tries not to actually push any policy, which is very clever of him. He allows you to make up your own mind as the reader, which is also something that he sort of subtly points to as being perhaps the only solution out of this, which is it's a clever sort of literary techniques that he's done there, is really speaking about that we can't defer to authority for matters of truth. We have to weigh it up for ourselves. And that consensus does not equal truth. You know, the ability of everyone to believe in a particular fiction, particularly when there are incentives in place to believe that something is true, even when it is blatantly not, because it's in our best interest to not think about, you know, things that could go wrong, or to not think about the people that we're harming through the policies that we enact, or whatever it may be. It does lead to the point that we can't defer to the crowd, and we can't defer to any individuals either, in order to determine what is truthful and what is not. but he also really speaks to the danger of having a world where nothing is true and everything is possible. And that phrase, nothing is true and everything is possible, was actually the name of his first book, which pointed to a lot of these same stories too.
And this idea then of apathy, because so often people also, it becomes too much trouble to think. And people, a lot of people become quite apathetic, I think, about information and truth and how best to deal with it.
Yes, exactly. So I think I spoke a bit earlier about the whole concept of postalgia, which is sort of hankering after the present moment because you don't believe the future is going to get any better than it gets. And there's another quote in his book that I think sums that up quite nicely, where he wrote, "The 20th century began with utopia and ended with nostalgia. The 21st century is not characterized by the search for newness, but by the proliferation of nostalgias," which is very, very interesting. I think he's speaking mainly there to the more developed world, that I'm definitely seeing signs of that, particularly in sort of youth research we do at Flux Trends, about exactly that, that sort of belief that nostalgia, the past was probably better than the future, and particularly the fictionalized past. Because that is, of course, the other catch, because the past can also be covered up by fake news or deepfakes. It can be manipulated by historians and by journalists and by news houses that perhaps want to, you know, paint present authorities in a nicer light than they might have done a few months ago. And there have been a few interesting case studies popping up there over the last week, too.
Absolutely. I mean, if you've ever sort of really wondered why the Queen goes to the cenotaph every year and puts a wreath on the grave at the cenotaph and the memorial at the cenotaph, and why people live nostalgically, and why memorial services are so important, and why anniversaries are so important, it is so that you can constantly either remind people of a glorious past or reinvent in the mind of the people who live in the present about a glorious past, whether it was glorious or not. And it is all of this real manipulation. How do we survive in this world, though, without becoming hard-bitten cynics and people who just simply don't believe anything anymore? Because I think the opposite of misinformation is the danger of that.
That total apathy. Well, exactly. We have to start thinking for ourselves. There's no sort of shortcut there. There has to be a degree of personal responsibility. I know that sounds often quite scary and quite unfair to people who are caught on the end of this, particularly when you start looking at some of the case studies that he goes into about how manipulative governments are against their own populations and how insidious those sort of campaigns are. But what we can start to do when we start to take responsibility for ourselves is start spotting the patterns. So one of the examples he used was a case study from the Philippines, where the ruling party was pretty much like a totalitarian party, basically a one-party state over there, had paid a marketing agency to go onto Facebook and to sort of slowly start to encourage people to start to associate the upcoming election with drugs being a problem. So what they did is they started random Facebook pages for everything from like cats to like kid pictures or whatever the case may be, the general interest groups. And then after the groups had reached 10,000-ish members, they started every day posting just like two comments, random comments on the page on each of those groups speaking about crime and then how crime must have been the cause of drugs, and they were able to then pass through much stricter drug legislation and get different sort of people elected at the end of that campaign. So you've got to start looking for those commonalities. You've got to start trying to spot those bots, and there are like little apps that you can download that can actually check what percentage of bot you are. I've run them by myself, and I found I'm like 0% bot, which I think is quite depressing, so I like to think of myself as being quite rational. But there are tools that we can use if we want to start seeing if the accounts we're following across social media are legitimate or not. And when it comes to sort of tail-eating snake of the news and the fictionalization of history or revisionist history, it's always well worth your while to start checking on those web archives that people have actually archived past versions of articles, so you don't start questioning your own sanity as you're being gaslit, you know, by media institutions, by public figures who are changing what they said in the past. But look out for those patterns, and as he says, read widely. It can't do you any harm.
Thank you, Bronwyn Williams, who does read widely. How many books have you read this month? It's almost the end of January.
But I think I'm on the 12th one now.
You're terrifying. You really are. Bronwyn Williams, the scariest reader in the world, a future finance specialist at Flux Trends this evening. 12 books. And she reads them. She internalizes them. She interprets them. She analyzes them. And then she brings it into the work that she does. And occasionally, she shares some of those insights with us.